little over 40 years ago, when I was 18 years old, I gave my newborn son up for adoption. 10 years ago, when he came to meet me for the first time since his birth, he brought an armload of books about how to witness to others about his Christian beliefs. Because I would like to make my son happy and proud of me, I have at times fervently wished that I could be converted to be a Christian. Sadly or not, that has not happened. But I have been reading a number of Christian books that I would not otherwise have read. And while reading, I've wondered why secular humanism is so demonized in some evangelical Christian writings. After mulling that over for a long time, I have come to some conclusions. To begin with, secular humanists are atheistic. By definition, humanism is being a good person without a supernatural religion to tell you how to be. I think the other reason could be called seniority or elapsed time. I was fascinated to discover that the secular humanist ideas date back to the Reformation, the Renaissance, Enlightenment period. They all followed right after the Middle Ages. And I'm not strong on dates, so when Barbara Tuchman in The Bible and the Sword said there wasn't really a consensus on one date when the Middle Dark Ages ended, but historians generally agree on several events that spread over 50 years. In 1454, the printing press was invented. In 1492, Columbus brought syphilis and massive numbers, murders of Indians to the New World. It's a little editorial comment. In 1494, Machiavelli, with his main idea that for any worthwhile end, it is permissible to use any means. That virus has been around ever since. In 1517, Luther nailed his writings up on the church's doors. And what I noticed in the Enlightenment time period was that the issue of the individual versus power elites, which is kind of my idea of what secular humanism is about, began with church reformers. We're just going to make the church a little better. As far as I could figure out, the Reformation was the combination of Luther getting really angry about the church selling pieces of paper that canceled sins. And that ended with Luther and hundreds of other priests and nuns leaving the Catholic Church and starting the splits that have been splitting ever since. Dendrites or roots, maybe. King Henry was the Eighth was breaking with the Pope and starting his own English church. And John Tyndall's idea that the Bible, not the Pope, should be the final authority for Christians. So following after the Reformation, which gave each individual Christian the opportunity to have their own printed copy of the Bible to interpret for themselves, people in the Renaissance Enlightenment time fell in love with the resurfacing manuscripts of the ancient Greek philosophers, primarily Plato's Socrates, idea to question everything. The Enlightenment's mottos were dare to know, sapere aude, live and let live, and reason is sufficient for happiness. Ever since the Enlightenment, colleges and universities have been basing their curricula on the ancient Greek ideal academic subjects. So using this as a basis, evangelicals claim that secular humanism is the religion of the United States and in total control of all levels of American schooling. And when we sit in humanist meetings, we sort of like, wouldn't that be nice? Live and let live. What a wonderful idea. The last thing that struck me was that fundraising might work better when there is the scare of claiming a massive conspiracy that has already taken over. So soldiers for Christ, take up the banner, you know, and save us. I don't have any final answers for anyone, even myself, but it was fascinating to learn where some of the roots of our ideas come from.
So Paul Kurtz, founder of the Council for Secular Humanism, writes succinctly that secular humanism rejects supernatural accounts of reality. It seeks to optimize the fullness of human life in a naturalistic universe. Secular humanism, or modernism, finds meaning in this life here and now and expresses confidence in the power of human beings to solve their problems and conquer uncharted frontiers. Secular humanism traces its heritage to Confucian China, to the Carvaka materialist movement in ancient India, and to the writers, artists, and poets of ancient Greece and Rome. Its origins can be glimpsed in early Greek philosophy, especially in its efforts to develop a theoretical, philosophical, and scientific outlook on nature, in its emphasis on rationality, and its conviction that the good life can be achieved through the exercise of human powers and the fulfillment of human nature. Protagoras stands out as a humanist in view of his statement that man is the measure of all things. However, humanistic strains can be seen in other Greek philosophers, the Sophists, who attacked then conventional morality and sought new ethical standards, as well as Socrates and Plato, who rejected the Homeric myths and sought to base ethics on rational inquiry. Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics has been taken as a model of humanistic ethics as it champions the life of practical wisdom, the fulfillment of virtue and excellence, and the achievement of well-being. Roman philosophy also expressed humanistic values. This was especially true of Epicureanism, Stoicism, and Skepticism. Humanism was eclipsed during the Dark Ages, during which faith dominated Western culture, and humans looked vainly outside of themselves to a deity for salvation. Humanism began to reappear with the rediscovery and translation by the Islamic philosopher Averroes of the works of Aristotle in the 12th century and their transmission to Europe during the Middle Ages. During the Renaissance, there was a turning away from the Bible back to classical pagan virtues and an effort to secularize morality, and humanism began to flourish again as a literary and philosophical movement. Writers emphasized that the good life and happiness were possible and that earthly pleasures were to be cultivated, not condemned. Philosophical humanists highlighted the dignity of human beings, their capacity for freedom, and the need for tolerance. Erasmus of Holland was especially noted as a humanist because of his defense of religious tolerance. The emergence of modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries enabled secular humanism to assume a recognizable form. Many thinkers helped to bring this outlook into being. For example, Montaigne expressed both skeptical and humanistic values. Spinoza, a bridge between the medieval and modern outlook, defended free thought, rejected biblical revelation as a source of ethics, paved the way for a new science of nature, and attempted to naturalize religion by identifying God with nature. The first major protest by what we may recognize as modern secular humanism was a defense of freedom of inquiry against ecclesiastical and political censorship. In part because of this, secular humanism and free thought are closely identified in the modern world. The fates of Bruno, burned at the stake, and Galileo, shamed and sentenced to house arrest for challenging traditional views of the cosmos, are central to the humanist call for freedom. It was the development of the scientific method and its application to nature that brought a decisive intellectual influence to bear on humanist thought. Humanists wished to use reason, as with Descartes, or experience, as with Francis Bacon, John Locke, and David Hume, to account for natural processes and discover causal laws. This meant that appeals to the authority of religious revelation and tradition were held illegitimate as a source of knowledge. The scientific revolution began with the impressive development of physics, astronomy, and natural philosophy. The Enlightenment, or Age of Reason, is testimony to humanist efforts to extend the methods of reason and science to the study of society and the human being. In the 18th and 19th centuries, there was widespread confidence that with the spread of reason, science, and education, human beings could be liberated from superstition and build a better world.
Good morning. My musings are about how we raise our kids to be ethical. I grew up in a fundamentalist church, and by the time I graduated from college at 23, I had quit attending church because I couldn't believe in the religion they were talking about. Becky was raised as a Catholic, but that didn't stick either. Therefore, religion rarely entered our minds those first 5 years we were married. Then we adopted Matt, and nearly 2 years later, Dan was born. I don't know if it was just me or both of us that thought we needed to start taking our boys to church so they would grow up to be ethical. Although I had left my beliefs about God behind, my religious instruction was still a part of me. Part of that indoctrination was that children needed to attend church if they were to be ethical adults. Therefore, Becky and I searched for a church to raise our kids in. First, we tried the United Church of Christ, and then we tried BOOF. For different reasons, we didn't find permanent homes in either place. Becky suggested that our boys could get their ethical grounding by participating in Boy Scouts, and we became actively involved in scouting, with both boys eventually earning their Eagle badge. Becky and I did come back to BOOF quite a bit later, and I joined the humanist group after it formed approximately 5 years ago. I have been very interested in the humanist take on ethics because I still believe that ethical training had to come from some authority source, especially a religious perspective. I continue to be very interested in the origin of ethics and how children learn to be ethical. Here's my current beliefs based on the ideas that I have gleaned as I participated in the humanist group. What we consider to be ethical behavior is in our genetic makeup to some extent. As our forebears' brains evolved with more and more capacity over millions of years, the need for more extended care for offspring increased. Our ancestors adapted by providing that care, and this appears to be the basis for altruism. Living in small tribal groups required cooperation, dealing with other members equitably, some measure of honesty, and putting the welfare of the group first. Since there are variations in small tribal group behavior, this behavior must be both learned as well as genetic. I recently, with Becky, watched a movie about Idi Amin, so I certainly understand that we have a considerable capacity for evil also. Human intelligence will continue to be applied to our ideas of ethical behavior. It's all we have to work with, and this will continue to change our ideas about ethical behavior. Recently, I listened to a CD of a concert of Dean Martin presented at the Sands Hotel in 1964. I was appalled by his mean-spirited humor at the expense of gays. What was acceptable in 1964 would cause quite an uproar in 2009 if he told these same jokes. Our collective conscience continues to change and grow. So my final point here, how do children learn their ethics? I have come to believe that children learn their ethics from the role models in their lives, most importantly their parents. When I responded to the misbehavior of our children angrily and harshly, I was teaching them that it was okay to deal with the powerless with disrespect. When we had family meetings and distributed the chores as equitably as possible, we were teaching our children a respectful use of power. When we paid the adult prices to get our children into movies because the theater deemed them to be adults at their current ages, even though we could have slipped them in at the children's prices, we were teaching them our values regarding honesty. Matt and Dan listened to what Becky and I said, but I believe they paid a whole lot more attention to what we did. Making the ethical choice between two options may require more effort and is more likely to expose an individual to hostility and ridicule from others. Ethical decisions making sometimes requires a measure of self-discipline, and we need to use our parenting skills to encourage the growth of self-discipline in our children if they are to become ethical adults. How does Boo fit in teaching our children to be ethical? This is an important place outside the home where our children can see ethical behavior modeled by words and deeds of other role models. In RE, our children participate in an ethical society and learn about ethical behavior. What our children see and learn at church will reinforce what they learn from us in home in regard to ethical behavior. And if you want to know more about ethics, we have quite a few handouts at a table in the back, and some of them do deal with ethical behavior in general as humanists approach that. Thank you.
My topic, which is not listed on your order of service, is humanism in mental health and mental health treatment. And it picks up right of where, you know, Rick left off. Humanism appeared in mental health as a break from the beliefs in supernatural interventions in the late 1800s, and it focused on internal forces which produced behaviors rather than external. Humanistic psychology developed by Abraham Maslow began to use more scientific approach through Maslow's study of the characteristics of successful people. He knew that all the focus up to that point had been on ill people, specifically neurotics. And he says, well, how do people do good? You know, so he studied successful people and found their characteristics. He listed a hierarchy of human needs, beginning with survival and ending with self-fulfillment. This list of needs is as pertinent now in mental health as it was when it was first described. And I don't mean when it was first developed, because these needs are something that appeared when we came down out of the trees. Humanism has a here and now focus and will keep abreast of discoveries and solutions as they're being reported. Every day there's something new. Humanistic therapists or whatever, teachers, look at these things and study them. Humanism embraces the physiological and genetic bases along with learned and belief-based causes for behaviors and the clusters of behaviors known as personalities. Less emphasis will be placed on motivation, which cannot be known by a clinician and is usually only poorly understood by the client. And more emphasis is being placed on decision-making, investigation of consequences, communication, and practicing the more socially acceptable or more rewarding behaviors. New and very hopeful to me are medications and assessments of brain function, which are providing a fast and large improvement in behaviors and changes in what in the past has been called attitude and personality. Medication now brings those who suffer schizophrenia back to normal thought processes within months. I have seen this happen before my eyes, and it was just like a miracle. Humanism will advocate for continued and controversial research to further lessen the tragedy of mental illness and to advocate treatment reimbursement on a par with other major and chronic illnesses, thereby reducing the stigma of mental illness as bad character. Humanism provides a framework of acceptance, communication, and openness. These comprise the environment in which mental health develops in a child and in which mental health can be regained. Thank
you. I am a humanist who believes there is no God that controls my life. But what do I do when life turns upside down? Where do I find the strength to get through life's rough spots? When it comes to facing a crisis, my religious friends find comfort believing that God is in control and doing what's best for all. God's will is unquestioned. God makes the ultimate decision for their fate. They beseech God for strength. They pray for guidance. But it's up to God what happens to them. My Christian family are comforted by the belief of an afterlife. Death is not the end of their existence. They believe they will be reunited with our loved ones again. This brings them solace in the face of grief of losing someone very dear. As a humanist, I believe that my life is controlled by physical laws of nature and my actions and the actions of others around me. I may not understand these forces or why they are what they are, but I know we are all subject to them. When my life is over, there is no more. So I had better make the most of what I have. But knowing this isn't enough for me to find my way out of my grief, my loneliness, my helplessness when it comes to having a crisis in my life. I need people. We all need family and friends to share our joys and sorrows. We all find strength and comfort when we have someone to listen to us, to stand by us, to be there for us. My religious friends have built in community that is there for them in good times and bad. This is probably the main reason they don't leave this community when they question their faith. Everyone needs to find a community like this fellowship. I know when I first left my family's religion, I felt shut out. My hope is that our humanist community can be our substitute for a religious community, one in which we feel safe and can find strength even when life deals us a blow.
What does it mean to be strong? And as a humanist, where do I find strength in a crisis? I've learned that being strong doesn't mean we don't cry or see a therapist or take medication if we need it. It means looking at a situation that comes into our lives realistically and making decisions that will benefit without a lot of emotion guiding our decisions. Being overly emotional can sometimes stand in the way of good decisions. When I was young, I looked to God for strength and solutions. At some point in my life, that wasn't working, and I decided I couldn't do that anymore. I tried to be strong when bad things happened by keeping them hidden from most others, family, friends, and neighbors. It seemed a sign of weakness to ask for help and show emotion in times of trouble. When I finally learned to open up to friends, family, I discovered that rather than being a sign of weakness, it was a sign of strength to allow others in at the worst times. They come through. I am stronger because they are there, even if they're there just in spirit. Reflecting on the past gives me strength. When my oldest sister began a search for information about our ancestors, our family was fascinated by what she learned. That led me to begin reflecting on the challenges our grandparents, great-grandparents, and others faced as they came to this country. And then I think of the people coming here today. My goodness, when I think of the strength needed to overcome the obstacles presented to them, am I so different that I could not do what many of them have done? My children give me strength, and in a way they push me to be strong. I am still their parent until the day I die. And they want me to be what they want to be when they are 70 years old or older. I look at the crises we are facing today, this week, the next couple of months. My husband and I have a running debate about which of us is a realist and which of us is an idealist. It often seems to depend on the situation. But we agree about the current possibilities our family faces and what we can do to help. And although I am not a religious person, I remember that oldest sister during a crisis in her life, quoting from the Bible, "And this too shall pass." And that is true, of course. And when the crisis has passed, we are never the same. My brother gave me a gift when he introduced me to humanism 30-odd years ago. While I agreed with the philosophy and read some information about it at the time and over the years, I didn't pay a lot of attention to joining anything or promoting it. It was my brother's thing, and it was a good thing. I didn't realize how much I had absorbed and what a gift it was until I look at how I've changed and how I've dealt with what we call a crisis. Humanism is part of me, and it gives me strength. While it's important to be anchored in reality to be strong in a crisis, we must have dreams. Dreams for the future inspire strength. Some of my dreams and strengths, consolation and escape, come from music and books. I need beautiful music, such as that I often hear in this room. I need good books, and I need dreams. I want to practice the piano more so I can play in a country garden. I want to read more of the classics someday. I want a horse again, like I had as a teenager on the farm in Wisconsin. I wish I had felt the freedom and had the permission to investigate earlier in my life.